This podcast is brought to you by IFR Magazine.
Hi, I'm Jeff Van West, editor of IFR Magazine. You know, after finishing an article for the magazine on the experiences of a female instrument instructor who trained World War II pilots, the infamous Link Trainer, I wanted to hear more about instrument training and the flying during the war from the pilots themselves. These guys can be hard to find. One of the pilots I spoke with was Jim Nolan. He flew B-17s out of England during World War II, and we started by talking about the IFR training he got, or perhaps didn't get, before flying in combat.
We just gave it the power and rolled down the runway and picked it off the ground, and we didn't know much about the instruments. Well, we didn't need to anyway. In primary training, you know, we didn't have any instrument training. I don't think we had any in basic training. Maybe it... When we got to B-17 training at Lockbourne Air Force Base, I think we're supposed to go down and get some Link trainer time. Mostly how to get it started and roll it down the runway and fly in formation until we get to the targets. We knew where we're supposed to be in the formation. You know, like I was usually in the lead squadron. They were through high, lead, and low. And in the lead squadron, the number one plane out front was the colonel or somebody flying his once-a-month mission. And then beside him on his right wing was the deputy lead in case the lead ship got shot down with the fighters coming in from the nose and shoot the pilots. And then I was underneath the lead ship. I wasn't supposed to do anything but just be there. Not too far from the field was what they call a Cottesmore buncher. You turn in the frequency and the radio compass needle would point at it. I guess you'd call it an ADF, maybe. And we put that on, you know, we'd turn until the needle was on the nose, and then we'd fly over the buncher, and then we'd make a gradual 360 as we climbed out to the assembly altitude, maybe 12,000. And then we'd kind of look at the buoys that were circling, and we'd figure, well, there's the lead squadron, there's the high squadron, I know where I'm supposed to be, and you try to put it in formation. Well, then we took off for the channel, and then other groups came in from different places to a contact point, you know, so they'd all form what they call a division column. And a few times, we couldn't assemble over England. We kept trying to assemble, but we were flying around in a circle in clouds. We don't know where the hell the rest of the guys were, but they're doing the same thing, and they keep changing the altitude that we should assemble at, you know, above the clouds. And we're flying primarily on the artificial horizon. You know, you look at that, and you get a little 40-degree bank, and your rate of climb says 300 feet a minute or something. And you're trying to go up in a circle to get up above it, then get in formation and leave. Sometimes they'd call on the radio and say, oboe, 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 which meant the mission was canceled. And then we'd all come scattering down through the clouds and circle the Cottesmore buncher and get on a heading of 157, which should take you over the field, and let down and hope you saw some chimneys and hills before you hit them. I don't think we even called in to get the field altimeter setting, which would be helpful, you know. And the theory was everybody would sit on the same heading and let down at 500 feet a minute. So first of all, they would loosen up the formation, you know, spread out a little bit so we weren't on each other's wingtips. And then at the same heading, you know, the guy up front would say, now we'll now descend. And everybody's supposed to be in the same heading and let down about at the same rate of speed. And then pop out underneath in perfect formation. But a lot of the guys... As soon as they dunked their nose in the clouds, they took off in different directions by themselves. They figured, I'm not going in those clouds and let down 10,000 feet with some guy that's supposed to be 20 feet off my wing, you know. I don't trust him. So sometimes I'd break out underneath, there'd only be like five ships out of 36 down there. The rest went, God knows where they went, you know what I mean?
I was wondering how you kept separation with all those airplanes in the clouds. So it sounds like there was no... hard plan for keeping the airplanes apart.
Yeah, the plan was perfect. Just sit on 157 and let down at 500 feet a minute and don't go over to 159 I'll go back to 148, you know, hold your heading, you know, for 5 or 6 minutes and pop out underneath. I remember one day we dropped into the clouds and all of a sudden my top turret gunner yelled that the plane was coming right over the plane. He was not going to follow the heading, you know, he was going to break off and fly 20 miles north and let down by himself. And he went right over my ship, almost took the top turret off the ship. But anyways, that was the plan on how to get down in weather and get back to the base. You know, they got these unmanned vehicles now in the war that take off and knock some guy out of his bed and come back to the strip in Australia someplace.
Right.
It's no fun now.
Another pilot I spoke with, who goes by the handle CB, wasn't a wartime pilot, but he did give me some insight into the early post-war flying with the airlines. He started by telling me how flying the old low-frequency AN ranges were a step up for him versus flying the airways made from flashing light beacons. This was real radio navigation.
Once again, I'm trying to remember how far the range stations were apart. They were further apart than the beacons were, because it was low frequency, and so you're not bothered by line of sight reception, you know. The airway, I believe, was 10 miles wide. Everybody flew on the right-hand side of the airway. You put your headset on and dialed up the station, and in one ear you would hear the Morse code N, the other ear you would hear the Morse code A. And if you were absolutely in the center of the airway, you would get a solid tone. So there you are, and everybody stayed to the right. Mm-hmm.
So how did you judge how far to the right you were if it's all an A or an N, depending on where you are?
The strength of the signal, because the further you got from the station, you understand the signal would spread out. So you pretty much flew a accomplished course, you know, and you'd have a little inkling of what the wind was. You know, to make some corrections, yeah. And of course, now when you got up in the later airplanes, like the old Lodestars, DC-2s, DC-3s, you had an ADF in there. So that simplified things greatly, because you knew where the station was. The needle should be pointing toward it, unless you were flying in a bunch of thunderstorms, and then the needle just sat there and went around in circles. But anyway.
Any other interesting stories about early instrument flying, either with you riding along, even as a flight engineer, tight moments?
The old guys I flew with on the Constellations now were primarily, well, I say primarily, an awful lot of them were the old airmail pilots. And if they wanted to make a damn approach, they'd go ahead and make one, you know.
And yeah. As the co-pilot, did you have anything to say in the matter, or even the flight engineer, or did you just... We're told to shut up and hang on.
You just didn't look out the window. No, I'm kidding. Nah, they weren't out to assassinate anybody, particularly themselves. The old guys used to say, you know, after a bad approach or something, a hard approach, he says, well, didn't nobody get wet or bloody anyway on that approach, you know. So that was a good one. And if you kept your eyes open and your mouth shut, you learned an awful lot. You really did. I felt very, very proud to have been associated with those old guys, and also learned a lot sitting in that seat. Yeah.
Now, CB, just so I know, how old are you?
I'm 62. 82. And I still fly. I flew yesterday.
Finally, I found Spencer Grant. He was an instrument instructor during the war. His comments about what made good training and a good pilot back then are probably just as valid today. It's just that few of us would have the guts or risk the ire of the FAA to do what was standard procedure back then.
I was lucky enough to be an instructor at Bryan Field, the instrument school. If you graduated from Bryan, Texas Instrument School, you were the best IFR pilot, one of the best IFR pilots in the Air Force. Joe Duckworth was our commanding officer. Joe Duckworth was an ex-Eastern captain. He used to tell us that we had the best training in the world. All we needed was experience. So he said, whenever you're not instructing, I want you to go get in one of the airplanes, either an AT-11 or an AT-6. Go out and get some experience and find the worst weather you can find and fly it. And his motto was, fly an IFR. There's only two things you need to worry about if you really know what you're doing, and that's hail and tornadoes. Thunderstorms are routine. His technique for flying severe turbulence, and I still believe in it, even though airlines don't, is the important thing is control your airspeed. And most recommended maneuvering speeds for airplanes are too high, put too much stress on the airplane. And if you control your airspeed, if you can do that, and sometimes that's not too easy, your airplane is not going to come apart. And you know what? It worked. It's not just theory, because we actually did go looking for thunderstorms to fly. And I think that Joe Duckworth did a lot in taking instrument flying in the military out of the realm of an emergency procedure to commonplace.
Let me ask another question. You said that you think that instrument training that you did down there was some of the best in the world. What made it the best in the world, in your opinion, besides going and looking for thunderstorms in the T-6?
It was nothing but spending hours and hours and hours practicing under the hood. And we did. And in practicing, we did a lot of flying on partial panel and all kinds of approaches. And Bryan Field had the second ILS system ever installed. We considered it a blind landing system. We actually would land and come to a stop, either in 0-0 or completely under the hood. And we had no minimums whatsoever, things that today are considered absolutely stupid. But the ILS back then was a little different than it is today. The indication was much more sensitive. Today, the needles are not as sensitive, and they're easier to fly, but not quite as accurate. And it's amazing how good you get if you get plenty of practice. And, of course, we still know, even today, that you need to practice. I don't care how good you are. If you don't practice, you're going to get sloppy.
Spencer, just how old are you now?
How old am I?
Yes.
People don't believe it. I had a birthday just about a week ago. We had some great parties. I turned 90.
And you still fly regularly?
Oh, yeah.
And what's your typical kind of flight in the RV-6? Are you out boring holes in the sky, gentleman's aerobatics? Are you cruising around the country?
Well, RV-6, I have a 220-horsepower engine in it, which makes it a real fireball. Its max cruise at 75% power is 212. And the thing about that RV-6, it's very economical. I fly it out to Montana every summer.
if you cruise with it not screws, it takes quite a bit of fuel. But if you pull it back so that your true airspeed is about 155, that thing will get 26 miles to gallon, which is pretty good.
And you fly that from Alabama all the way to Montana?
I always fly IFR because it's amazing. But most of the legs, you're going to run into some clouds someplace. So you follow IFR and don't have to worry about it.
So long as you're still that sharp, you're not too old to fly IFR. I'm Jeff Van West for IFR Magazine and AvWeb. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been brought to you by IFR Magazine. For more on IFR, log on to www.ifr-magazine.com.